We live in a culture that is infatuated with love. Love, or the romance of love, forms the basis of many of our songs, or much of our advertising, the films, the box sets that we watch. And there's a sense always that love wins, love triumphs. If only we could be more loving towards each other, then all would be well with the world. And of course, there's much truth in what is being expressed. If we all loved selflessly, then the world would be a better place. And if we could learn to disagree in love, things would be better. Brexit would be easier. Relational tensions would be less stressed. And on one level, we should not be surprised that the non-Christian world grasps those things. I mean, after all, we're all made in the image of God, and 1 John 4 tells us God is love. And at the heart of the Trinity is love. And of course, ultimately in the book of the Song of Songs, what we begin to see is what it is to love in the truest sense, at the deepest level humanly, which can only be truly expressed between two persons, a man and a woman, in the safety of marriage. Yes, love is a wonderful, important thing, but it can also be a confusing and misunderstood thing, especially in the context of romance, as our culture reveals. And so as the book finishes, it's that love that's now shown and in many ways defined. And the first thing we see is that love endures. In verses 5 to 7, love endures. See verse 5, that the friends are asking, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? And it seems to be a picture now of the couple, possibly in older age, but certainly further on in their marriage, with the wife leaning on her husband, still together, still intimate, still close. And coming out of the wilderness seems to be expressing the idea of coming out of trials. Wilderness in the Bible is often seen as times of difficulty. Think of the Israelites in the desert, in the wilderness for 40 years. Here's the couple, having ridden the trials and difficulties of life, and they've come through them together. That's probably what's being picked up in what's expressed next, as the wife reflects in verse 5. Of the apple tree where she roused him, where they were intimate. And then there's this slightly odd reflection of his mother giving birth to him, which is probably a metaphor, I think, for expressing wilderness and pain again. As his birth gave pain to his mother, so their love has been birthed through trials, refined through difficulties. That's often the case as well, isn't it? Couple will go through difficult seasons, which might be as a result of their own sinful actions, words, as in chapter 5, verse 2. It might be because of the hardships that come at them, illness, outside pressure, work, family. And where the couple seek to work it through, not run, it often results in a deepening of the marriage. That would certainly be Ros and I's testimony as we walked through trials and difficulties and hardships, that the outcome has been a greater closeness in the marriage, a deepening of our love for one another. And of course, that's true of our relationship with Jesus, isn't it? That often through the trials of life, my love for him deepens. So we shouldn't be afraid of difficult seasons. All marriages will have them. But see them as opportunities to deepen our love, to serve the other, to lean on the other, as the wife here leans on her beloved. And this love that goes through the difficulties and the trials, that endures, is a love that is both protective and possessive. Have a look at verse 6. Verse 6, in many ways, is like a summary verse of the whole book. Remember, it's speaking of love in the context of marriage. It's marriage as God's designed it. And within that, it allows for love to be protective and possessive. So verse 6, the wife speaks of wanting to be like a seal over his heart, like a seal on his arm. in the Old Testament times, a seal was used to indicate ownership of a person's most valued possession. So here's the wife, and she's asking to be her husband's most valued possession, to be imprinted on the heart as a seal of another, is to be inseparable from that person. As long as his heart beats, she wants to know and feel his love. Be a seal on her husband's arm is a picture of safety and security and strength. He's her defender. His arm is protective of her. And of course, that which you deem most valuable, that which is closest to your heart, you protect. You do all you can to ensure its safety and its security. So here's a protected, sealed love. It's going to be a love that protects from all threats that may come at the marriage, both from within and outside of. So he's going to deal with the foxes, remember them? The little foxes that can destroy the marriage. Maybe it's our own sin. Maybe it's areas that we notice within the marriage that seek to threaten it. Our own laziness, our own weaknesses, our own pride, our own words. How we speak to one another. I think one of the most lethal weapons in a relationship is the little chipping of one another with hurtful and sarcastic barbs. And this is deadly, especially when done in front of others. We saw last week that we were to speak well of our spouses. We're to speak well to them and about them. We're to be creative in that, especially husbands. We're to seek to express delight in and encourage our spouses by magnifying their strengths and not their weaknesses. We're to take pride in our spouses, praising them, protecting them with our words, not destroying each other with our words. And how easy it is to do that. But you protect that which is most valuable to you. And the way we do often speak is an area that we need to think of. And husbands, we're the primary defenders. We need to be taking the lead about ridding our marriages from the foxes, from that which harms it. It's easy for us to think as husbands about kind of defending our families from intruders in our home. But the biggest intruders are those which are unseen. Those of our sin. And our attitudes and our thinking and our words that can do the most harm to our marriages. And such protectiveness will nurture love. It will allow for love to endure. In fact, look what the wife says next, because such sealed love, she says, is as strong as death. Just as death is a certainty, it's unbreakable, so is love. When it's protected and sealed, it becomes resolute and irresistible and unshakable. And it's going to be possessive and passionate. See what she says next? It's jealousy, unyielding as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. This blazing, passionate love is like a raging forest fire, burning with such intensity that no one can control it. In fact, verse 7, it's inextinguishable. Many waters cannot quench such love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. Even money cannot buy it. A love that is protective and strong will be possessive, jealously so, like an all-consuming fire. Jealousy in this context is altogether right. Jealous that this love would not be shared but exclusive, reserved only for each other. And the picture of it as a consuming fire means it's a love that will destroy all that stands in its way, which includes other relationships. Over and over throughout the song, we've seen how the wife has turned away from friends, and instead seeking intimacy and praise from her husband. There's a jealous, possessive love hitch which will demand that intimacy that is both said and physical remains in the marriage and only the marriage. It's not looking for that intimacy, even if words spoken by friends, it looks for it in the marriage. How we relate to the opposite sex, or to be as brothers and sisters with no hint of sexual immorality, so no flirtation even in jests, no little touch or extra looks, to give no reason for our spouses to be jealous. We're jealously guarding our love for our spouse. And they're right to be jealous for it. A jealous love will consume our selfishness. Often what can destroy a marriage is not another relationship, but our selfishness. So anything that consumes my time unhelpfully, my spouse, I think, is right to be jealous of that. If I'm consumed by a particular hobby, gaming or work, none of these things are wrong in themselves, but if I'm consumed by them to the detriment of loving my spouse, well, my spouse is right to feel jealous of that. And one of the areas I think we need to watch in our age is the idolization of children, where love for them begins to push out my love for my spouse. If I am loving the kids more than my spouse is right to be jealous of that. See, we need to ensure that love for our spouse after Christ comes first, before the children. That we love our husbands and wives more than our children, so that our love for each other will then overflow rightly, abundantly to our children as well. But to be jealous of anything that threatens that love between a husband and a wife, where that love is sealed and protected and possessive and jealous for, that love that is as strong as death, which will be unbreakable and irresistible and resolute, it will endure if it's being protected and jealously guarded, consuming all that might get in its way. See, how does Paul describe love in 1 Corinthians 13? He says it bears all things, it believes all things, it hopes all things, it endures all things. Love never ends. Much of the world's love is often more fairy tale. It's based on feelings and emotions and infatuations than it is on action that seeks to protect and jealously guard rightly. And love for our spouse is a reflection of just how Christ loved his church. See, Christ's love for the church is a jealous, protective love, isn't it? If you look at the end of verse 6, it says it burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. And if you look at the footnotes, it may be that it's actually saying the very flame of the Lord. Some dispute because of just a few little words at the end of that word, mighty, that has God's name, Yah, the first bit of it attached to it. So it may just be that it's of the Lord. But in one sense, that would parallel well, wouldn't it? The jealousy that the Father and the Son have for their church, for Jesus is for his people, his bride, is one that is all-consuming and blazing. Jesus' love for his bride is all-consuming. Our love for him is to be all-consuming. But not to allow anything to get in its way, as those sealed for him, Revelation 9 or Ephesians 1. Jesus' name is written on our foreheads, we're his. Romans 8 tells us nothing can separate us from his love, not even death, and Jesus jealously guards it. He is to be first and foremost in our hearts. And of course, in many ways, that's a great comfort for us, the believer. That his love for us, one that seeks to protect us and do what is best for us, and he jealously guards it. It's a love that's unbreakable, as strong as death and inextinguishable. And our marriages are to reflect that. It's the kind of love we're to have for our spouse. A love like Christ has for his church. And note then where all this starts. So there's a reflection in verses 8 to 10 on the life of on the wife's in her youth. See, love endures is a love that is guarded. See verses 8 to 10. It seems that the friends here are the wife's brothers. They're speaking, they're thinking back to her childhood. Verse 8, we have a little sister, her breasts have not yet grown. What should we do for our sister on the day she's spoken for? So on her wedding day. Well, they go on. Verse 9, if she is a wall, we'll build towers of silver on her. If she's a wall, speaks of moral purity, sexual unavailability. If she demonstrates such character, they will honor her as a tower of silver. If she is a door, indicating moral and sexual availability, weakness and failure, they'll enclose her with panels of cedar. they will wisely and of necessity restrict her freedom and opportunities for sexual foolishness and misbehavior. And we discover, verse 10, she's been like a wall. She's remained sexually pure and unavailable. Now she's all grown up. And she's become, in her eyes of her husband, like one bringing contentment, or literally peace. And again, throughout the song, we've been encouraged, don't arouse or awaken love until it desires. And God's design is that sexual intimacy is within marriage alone. And her brothers in that culture have taken that seriously, and they've done all they can to encourage her to remain sexually faithful. And the result is that in her husband's eyes, she brings him contentment and peace. She's bringing mutual delight and joy and well-being. There's a peace in the marriage as it begins, because there's no emotional baggage from past relationships to be dealt with. There's no jealousy of what was. There's no sense of passion being used up prior to the marriage. It's within it. There's a peace, a contentment. And you can see the implication. Failure in this area will bring a non-peace and possibly discontentment. Now let me say, I recognize that many of us have failed in this area prior to marriage. And hear me when I say this does not mean peace is unachievable. But it has consequences. There are often issues that will need to be discussed, awkward conversations to be had, jealousy, emotional baggage to be dealt with, that can bring a sense of feeling of non-peace to the marriage in the early days and at times maybe throughout. However, because of Jesus and his death and resurrection, forgiveness is found, shame is covered, peace established, reconciliation made possible, and because of the gospel, marriages can thrive. They can be places of peace and contentment, even when there has been failure, and many of us can testify to that. But it might take work and grace and bearing with and love, but with Jesus' help, it can be and will be overcome. And Jesus himself doesn't take a perfect bride. He takes one that is stained, one that is sinful, one that is guilty, that is shame-filled. And in his love, he unites himself to us, and he brings forgiveness and cleansing and hope. And as he does that to us individually, that same forgiveness and cleansing and hope then spills into our marriages, and it helps us to deal with each other's sin and mess and brokenness. And none of us come to marriage perfect or without sin. We're all broken. But as those trusting in Christ, we can know his help and his power to enable us to build marriages that last, marriages that are content and peace-filled, where there is mutual delight and joy in each other. And yet we want to do all we can to walk as those who love Jesus and follow his ways. And my plea to those who are not married, as the brother's plea, as it were, to their sister, kind of the community pleading and saying, God's design and purpose is that sex is for within the married relationship. And hear the encouragement of verse 10, where that has been the case, peace and contentment is found. And following God's purposes will guard you from much hurt and consequences. Heed the words of the wife. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires within marriage. Love is to be guarded until that day. And then thirdly, love is a gift. Have a look at verses 11 to 12. Now these are two of those verses where commentators can't agree. Is it speaking of Solomon and his many wives? Is it speaking of him in a bad light? Is it speaking of his wealth alone? It's hard to know. What I think is clear is that there's a sense here of the husband having much, maybe wealth, but whatever he has, whatever else he might be able to gain and obtain because of his wealth and his riches, he cannot buy or just have his wife. Obviously, look at verse 12a, right in the middle, she expresses to him clearly, but my own vineyard is mine to give. Her body, her love, is for her to give, not for him to take, not for him to assume. She belongs to no one except the one to whom she chooses to give herself. Solomon may own thousands of possessions, but she's given as a gift. And just as we saw briefly in verse 7, love cannot be bought. And so we see it again. Love is given as a gift. It's a privilege, not an obligation, to give our bodies to one another and to give yourself to another person. And the truth is, we must never lose sight of that, that it is a privilege and a blessing to receive the affection and love of our spouse. You cannot earn it. You don't deserve it. We freely give it. And in such an enticement culture, so often we think we're so entitled to much that I can begin to think I'm entitled to my spouse's love. Now, on the one hand, I am, you know, to jealously guard it. But it's not a demanding, self-centered, expressive, controlling love that just demands. It's worth remembering, love is freely given. So do you ever just look at your spouse and think, God gave her to me? Or God finally crafted this man for me? See, we should. Because true love always has the quality of a gift. I mean, again, think of Jesus' love for his church. But we're not entitled to it. He freely gives us, freely loves us. The Father gives his only Son. The Son gives his life for us. Love's a gift. It's a privilege. We must be careful not to abuse it, to assume upon it, to take advantage of it. And it's easy to do. To not appreciate, to not value, to not express that. I mean, I see it in my relationship with Jesus. I take his love for me for granted, as if I deserve it, as if I'm entitled to it and to his blessings. If I do that with Jesus, then I'm sure to do it with my spouse. And in both, I must see the gift of love for what it is, a gift. And with that idea ringing in our ears, the book comes to a close. And once more, words of love are being expressed. Love is ongoing. See, the husband still delights in his wife. See, verse 13, you who dwell in the gardens with friends in attendance, let me hear your voice. Even after many years of marriage, he's still eager to hear her voice. He finds delight in conversing with the woman he loves. Their marriage has not settled into a boring routine. He still eagerly desires and delights in her. This marriage is one that is ongoing. It's still maturing. It's still taking interest in. It's still expressing words of love and romance. He's still all in for her. And she responds, verse 14, come away, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains, her breasts. And she's inviting into intimacy to make love to her, for him to enjoy her like a gazelle, a young stag, bounding energy, ongoing. Her delight in him has not dimmed with time. She wants him to have that same eager spirit in making love to her as he displayed when they were young. Within marriage, intimacy can continue undisturbed. She's still pursuing him. Her love for him is so great that time is of no consequence. There is no yesterday, no tomorrow. It's an ongoing love. See, the book doesn't finish with a sense of completion, sense of we've made it, but of an ongoing, maturing, deepening intimacy and love that just goes through the ages. Because love in relationships are never complete. They're always ongoing, always delighting in and maturing. I'm sure many of you have had this same thought, that on your wedding days you stand before your spouse, you think you could not love them anymore. And yet, 16 years later, I can say with all honesty, I love Roz more today than I did then. As you travel through life together, as you enjoy and delight in each other, love deepens. It continues to grow. And I imagine for those who are married even longer than 16 years, they would say that they love their spouse even more than they did when they'd been married 16 years. Because that's the way God designed it. love never completes. I mean, think of Jesus' love for his bride. Ephesians 3, Paul speaks of love immeasurably, that we would know how wide and deep and long Christ's love is for us. We'll never quite grasp the extent of Jesus' love. We'll always be growing in our marriage to him. There'll never be a time when we think we've made it. In a similar way, in our marriage, our love will continue to grow and to deepen. Because biblical love is a love that endures. It's a love that guards. It's a love that gives. It's a love that's ongoing. It's a love that's protective and rightly possessive. And where that is the case, we will have marriages that are as strong as death, as unyielding as the grave. Is that not what you desire for your marriage? Not just great sex, but a lasting, ongoing, deepening love.